prize. I've already got the prize. The prize is the pleasure of finding a thing out.
The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
You realize when you know how to think, it empowers you far beyond those who know only what to think.
And we're live. All right. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the first episode of the currently unnamed U of Guelph Physics Podcast. I'm sure by the time everyone will be listening, there will be a name for it. So today I'm joined
You never know.
So today I'm joined by my co-host and the Physics Club president, Mr. Josh Cadogan. Josh, how are you?
Good. How are you, Elliot?
Not too bad.
I'm excited we're getting this going finally.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been in the works since the summer. So it's good to see it happening. So to give a quick intro to our guest. So we're actually joined by one of our professors at the university. He is a 26-time Guinness World Record holder with feats such as the most motorcycles driven over a human body while laying on a bed of nails in 2 minutes. And if that doesn't tickle your fancy, there's also the heaviest truck pulled from flesh hooks in the back, which is just insane. He's a graduate of the University of Guelph and holds a bachelor's degree in physics with a minor in mathematics, a master's degree in experimental polymer physics. He's an entertainer, science educator, and communicator. Professor Burnaby Q. Orbax, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hello. Just to raise a small technical point, I'm not actually a professor. Even though I've taught upwards of 60 courses, I was a sessional lecturer.
All right. Well, shoot. I guess I'm fired.
I was just a contract teacher. A physics mercenary, dropped behind enemy lines, trying to shove information down the throats of 20-somethings.
Incredible. Well, you did a great job. You had me fooled. I could have sworn you're a professor, but anyway.
I guess constantly. I claim to know all types of things. So in many ways, if you were to look at the classic terminology as a noun, I am a professor. Yes, as a verb, I am a professor.
Fair enough then. All right, so we'll jump right into the segment. So we're going to ask you sort of a series of questions just pertaining to your work with the Monsters of Schlock, your work as a sessional lecturer, and throughout your degree. So I guess we'll start off.
That's a good recovery there. I saw you switch gears right from professor to sessional lecturer. No problem. That's good podcasting.
You're supposed to let the audience figure that out. They have me found out now. Shoot.
Well, if it's like anything else that I've participated in, we'll have a very small audience. So.
Fair enough. Awesome. I'll jump right in though. I wanted to ask you. I don't know if this is controversial or not, but your real name is of course not Burnaby Q. Orbax. I wanted to ask you though, how did you sort of come up the name with that? And on top of that, are you and Sweet Pepper Klopak really brothers?
Yeah. No. Pepper and I are brothers.
Okay.
And when I started entertaining, I guess over 20 years ago now, it's fairly common for entertainers to take a stage name. I was working in what we would call, I guess what we now call a daredevil stunt show, what we would then have just called a freak show. And so the Great Orbax sounded like a fairly apt name for a ringleader in a freak show. So I adopted that name. And it's just come to kind of represent the manifestation of sort of choosing my own path in life. So I've decided to continue to go by that name and to carve my own path.
Fair enough. Is it sort of demeaning to call your act a freak show? Is there a stigma?
Oh, no.
That?
I mean, I call it a freak show all the time because that is what it is. In the traditional sense, it's a freak show. The freak shows of the early 1900s, late 1800s, we would be known as what's called working acts. Mm-hmm. So a working act is an individual who through basically just practice has been able to adapt or to change their body to do some type of incredible feat. So unlike the natural borns, who have some type of genetic predisposition towards being in that type of entertainment, a working act learns a stunt, a trick, something as simple as what got me into sideshow, which was called the human blockhead. So the human blockhead's an act where you basically hammer nails into your sinus cavity. It was popularized under that name by a gentleman named Melvin Burkhart, who used to travel in the early 1900s in a freak show. And he could hammer a 20 penny nail directly into his face all the way back to the back of his skull. Now, he'd been a boxer in the army, so he had what was, I guess, one would eloquently describe as a completely destroyed septum from getting punched in the face a bunch of times.
Rather than a moderately destroyed septum?
Yeah. So he could fit quite large things in there, even though his nose still had the shape externally of a nose. The separating layer inside that separates the two sides of your nasal cavity had kind of been all smashed up. So he could put large objects in there. Now, I've been fairly lucky in that my nasal cavity is much taller than it is wide. So I can do things like not only insert a nail, I could put in, say, something like a fork, like the handle of a fork, where it's very, very wide in one dimension, but not so much in the other. So I can put something like that way back inside my skull, but not actually twist it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And that was sort of how you were able to, that's why something sort of more round and cylindrical, like a nail, you were able to do that.
Yeah.
Rather than, yeah.
Yeah. So now the nail that I use isn't necessarily as wide as the one that Melvin Burkhart used to use, but it also goes back about as far. So I can get back to about 5 3/4 inches into the back of my skull before it hits the downspout, if you will, from where your nasal cavity goes down your throat into your stomach.
Right. Wow.
Is it always the same nail, or do you have like a set of your favorite?
I've got a special nail that I had made out of stainless steel so that I could keep it sanitized, as it would make sense. I mean, if you're using sort of store-bought over-the-counter nails, if they get rusty, if there's like a nick in the corner of it, if there's slivers of it flaking off, anything like that basically shouldn't be 6 inches deep inside of your face. So you don't want to scratch that area. You don't want to also leave debris, right? You don't want to get a piece of rust stuck in your soft palate, and you don't want anything that's too sharp that you'd actually be able to poke the back of your head with. So I have had several sets of stainless steel nails over the years, of different types that I've used, but you know, I'm not so posh that I can't just pick up a regular over the counter 30 cent nail. But I was, when I was starting, you know, there's sort of all these variations on that act. There's, you know, people will stick anything in there, a drill. You can do nails, like we previously mentioned, a fork, a spoon, anything like that. But when I had started, I had heard the horror story about a performer who was using chopsticks. And instead of having like the plastic or wax coated chopsticks that you can get, he had used a freshly snapped open wooden set. And so he inserted it in to show somebody. And as he pulled it out, he got a small sliver of it stuck under the bottom side, or I guess the above the top side of your soft palate, the bottom side of your nasal cavity. And as he pulled it out, it just continued to splinter and drive that piece just straight through the mucous membrane of the bottom part of his face there. And the cringeworthy nature of that and the successive hospitalization of that individual led me to be play on the safer side and to go with a custom-made stainless steel nail rather than just found objects.
All right.
I guess that's a good reason. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't want stuff stuck in there. It's bad news.
I have an image that won't be leaving my mind for a while then. That's incredible.
It's a classic scare factor for safety, right?
No, absolutely. No. That's drive nails into your skull safely. That's been my motto since I was a kid. So thank you for
no problem. So I started by learning that type of stuff. I was very much a traditionalist in terms of I wanted to learn sort of all of those classic sideshow acts. Like, I wanted to learn how to swallow swords. I wanted to learn how to eat fire, how to walk in glass, how to lay on a bed of nails. So when I started by sort of learning all of those traditional stunts. Moving forward from that, we've done quite a few different sort of modern variations on all that. We do a lot of comedy in our show as well. But originally, my sort of was sort of twofold. I was almost sort of a had a historical interest as well as an entertainment interest, if that makes any sense.
Right. Right. No, that's pretty incredible. So with that in mind, then, now that you have sort of some time over quarantine, you have some time to think. Do you have you thought about world record number 27? You thought about what you're going to do for that?
Well, we're just chomping at the bit to get out there and do something. I mean, when this all hit, it was March, and we basically sat and watched our entire calendar for the year sort of evaporate going into like the next year. I mean, so we had tours in the UK and in Ireland canceled. We had this would have been our 13th year at our regular gig that we do at the PNE in Vancouver for Fright Nights, and then that disappeared. And prior to that, in January, I think it was actually December 30th or 31st, I had a retinal detachment, so my retina just peeled off of my eyeball, and I had to go in to get surgery to get that replaced. So I was grounded from doing shows up until about March 4th or 5th. I got the okay by the doctor to go out and gig again. I did that Bill Nye show at the university. We flew down to New Orleans and did two shows there. Flew home. We're like, all right, back at it. And then literally within like 3 or 4 days, quarantine hit and everything sort of just disappeared. So we're ready and ready to go for something new. We just need to be able to get an opportunity to get out there and do it.
Of course. Yeah. On that note, though, does your doctor, do you go to the same doctor? Does he kind of like, ah, oh, no, what did he put in his skull again? That kind of thing? Or do you have like a very kind of...
I have a very understanding family doctor who's taken fantastic care of me over the last 20 years. I actually saw him when he was a doctor over at health services there at the university when I was doing my undergrad. And he's taken care of this terrible train wreck of a health career of mine ever since.
Right. Fair enough.
Cool. So I'm a little curious then. You've talked a little bit about how you got like started, or rather what your initial interests were in the entertainment industry, but what did the first kind of few stages of that look like? Cause now you're saying you tour around internationally, but I think I remember hearing you say during the Bill Nye thing that you
I originally grew up in the Windsor area. Actually, in Maidstone, I grew up on a farm, and so I was surrounded by a lot of books and comic books and terrible television out of Detroit, and that's kind of what formed the basis of my. I mean, our interests in entertainment, no matter how much we try to deviate from them, I think are formed when we're very young. Based on the kind of media that we consume at that point. And I notice a lot of people sort of always turn back to that. So I was always very interested in monster movies, in professional wrestling, and all that type of stuff. So when I sort of came to my own of wanting to be an entertainer, I wanted to incorporate a lot of that stuff. And I thought, you know, what was when the first time that I saw a sideshow perform, I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. Like, this is everything that I want. It's real life monsters. It's wrestling storytelling. It's comic books. You can be a superhero. You can do everything. And you can show people that the human body can achieve these things that you never even thought it was possible of doing. And you can present it however you want. You can be spooky. You can be funny. You can be dramatic. It can be, it can tell a story. So for me, that was kind of what I wanted to do. The first iterations of this, there isn't really, see in Europe and in the UK, cabaret and vaudeville and that type of entertainment was still a thing. 20 years ago, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s here in Canada, I mean, that was even before burlesque kind of made a big comeback, before drag made a big comeback. So there really wasn't any way to create that kind of scene, you know, if that makes any sense. So I was working a lot with... getting myself on shows with bands and working in between the bands. Because at the time, a typical band show would be, you know, four or five bands. There'd be like half an hour to an hour strike between them. You know, people would be inside watching the show, and then they go outside and smoke or stand by the merch table or hang out or whatever. But people were just basically there to see a band of the five play, not to see the whole thing as if it were an entire spectacle. So I started working in between those bands because I'd be like, well, I could fill the time in between. I can work in a small space in front of the stage, just on the front and the corner while they do the changeover. And I could perform, and it would make it seem more of a cohesive thing with an actual host for the evening. So that's how I kind of started trying to get in front of people and to perform.
That's actually very similar to a business strategy called the Blue Ocean Strategy. I don't know if you've heard.
I have not.
That, instead of trying to find a market to break into or an industry to break into, you create your own genre of that industry. So instead of looking for sideshow acts to latch onto, you found that there weren't any sort of nearby, or you found there was sort of this niche for it, and then you just created your own opportunity for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to call me an innovator. I mean, I wouldn't say that about myself personally, but hearing you say that makes a lot of sense. I really was ahead of the time and a trailblazer. Those are very kind words. Thank you.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, no worries. So we'll move on to sort of our second set of questions. Josh, I don't know if you want to go ahead and take the lead on this one.
Yeah, for sure. So you said you started a bit younger, and when you're a bit younger, you don't really quite know all the physics that maybe you do now as a
postmaster. One might be able to argue that I know no physics whatsoever.
Well, okay, that might turn this question a bit null and void, but how do you come up with your stunts? Is there a bit of a apply your physics background a bit,
or do you just find something cool? Really want to have this vision of, you know, you're sitting down at a chalkboard and you're running equations, or you're writing down the formula of how heavy a thing you can break on yourself when you're on a bed of nails. And I mean, it's a fun romantic idea, but I think in the end, for what Pepper and I do, the starting point or the ending point of any stunt has to be a gag. So we're trying to make it funny. We're trying to present it as a joke. And there's acts that we hold on to for years and years and years because we still haven't figured out the best way to present it in a funny way. So for us, the first part is trying to figure out quote unquote, a bit for it or a gag. Then it's learning the stunt and putting the stunt in. That's kind of how we go about it. In terms of the science of it, I think really what it comes down to is being a good critical thinker, and understanding your limitations and understanding the idea of mitigating the amount of danger that you put yourself into. I often use this example. You know, we've interacted over the course of the 20 years of doing this, we've interacted with all types of people and stunt performers of all shapes and sizes. And in the midst of kind of doing that, the show Jackass kind of took off. And so you had a new generation of stunt crews that were kind of forming, that were performing basically for YouTube audiences, right? And chatting with a lot of them, they could do some incredible things, but here's what we always said, you know, anybody can go out on stage and break their arm and say, look how crazy that is, and then walk off stage and that's it. But that's not an act. I mean, for what you're doing, for a stunt to be an act, for a thing that you're doing to be a proper stunt, you have to be able to perform it 2-3 times a day, 3-5 times a week. And with an act like that, I mean, you can only do it twice until you have to take some time off. So that was a joke about breaking two arms. I understand I'm going a little bit fast there for you guys, but that's okay.
For sure.
So, you know, for something like that, you know, when we tour, we might do some of these festivals where you're doing three shows a day over. Well, I mean, case in point, last year we were in Ireland doing the Leia City Spectacular. So we were doing Dublin and Cork over 2 weeks, and we did over a 3-day weekend. We did like 12 shows. So you have to understand what you're doing in terms of the stunt you're performing, how to do it safely, and also understand how to build a show around it.
And does that mainly come from knowing your own limitations, or just sort of basing it off of what other people have been able to do and then trying to replicate that?
Yeah, I think you really, with that type of thing, if you're copying somebody else's act, you're not going to go very far very quickly. Mm-hmm. For two reasons. One, because people call you out on it, and it's very much frowned upon. It'll sort of drum you out. It'd be like stealing somebody's research.
Right.
But secondly, and more importantly, because if you don't connect to the act, then there's no authenticity there. If you're not passionate about what you're doing, you might be able to hold that down as a 9-to-5 job and still make it palatable. But if you're not passionate about what you're doing and you're in front of people trying to get them excited about what you're doing, why should they care if you don't? So, you know, we try to base a lot of what we do, like I said, comes from sort of a comedic angle or something that makes us laugh or it seems funny to us. But a lot of it is just, as you do these shows, things just kind of organically work their way in, if that makes any sense. It's like if you're in a band and you play the same two songs in a row all the time in your set list, you might find a fun way to transition from the one into the other that just works one night, and it just becomes part of the act from there on. And you might not even ever remember where it came from, but it has become a vital part of what you do.
Right. I was mainly sort of, I didn't want to say steal. I think that was a bit too intense, but sort of, there've been plenty of bed of nail tricks done before by previous sort of performers. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking in terms of, you know, maybe they did some things or techniques to increase the efficiency of the act. And then you would take some of the tips and tricks that they used.
Yeah, sideshow is a lot less friendly than a lot of the other disciplines. So there's a lot of people who sort of hold on to those things as tightly guarded secrets. I feel that we should be helping each other and stopping people from getting hurt needlessly. So I'm very happy in a lot of cases to at least point people in the right direction, and to try to teach. I mean, you know, just to learn. But yeah, we've met pretty much everybody in the world. That sounds ridiculous. We met pretty much everybody in the world who does this, but sideshow is a pretty small community, and we've met people, a lot of our peers, I guess, and contemporaries by this point. And it's interesting. You'd be surprised at how much people want to share ideas, and then also at the same time, how many times people want to hold on to things. I guess it's like anything else, really. Like even in academia, and research, people who want to share their information with other people under the idea that more, or they're looking for a fresh perspective on something, or the people who want to guard it as their own.
And is there sort of a, I don't want to say sideshow science, but are there sort of things that you could kind of look at from a physics perspective and go, oh, if I move my arm this way on, let's say, a bed of nails, it'll increase the surface area and relieve this amount of pressure?
There's all that type of stuff that you think about before you do it. But you'd be shocked after like motorcycle number 5, how much of that just goes out the window right away. Best ideas are sometimes best in when you're doing the research ahead of time. But yeah, a lot of it tends to go out the window.
Okay. I maybe not motorcycle number 5 for me. I think motorcycle number 1, everything would go out the window.
Yeah, Josh, motorcycles they're scary. It was, I said, it's funny. I've been reliving this story a lot lately on different podcasts, and but I assume this will be a completely different audience, so I might as well just share it as well. But it's an interesting thing. I didn't realize how scary that would be. Before doing it, I was more sort of like you were saying, focused on the logistics and the mechanics of making it happen, and on how you go about doing it. And when I laid down for the first practice one, it was so bizarre because you're laying there and I'm holding a ramp that's coming across my chest down. I'm kind of in a spread eagle position. It goes down between my legs and it touches the ground between my legs, so that the bike runs up the ramp sort of straight line right across my body and jumps. And I remember just sitting there or laying there and holding it. And I'm looking at the ramp because, I mean, even if you look down, you can't see it. You want to lay prone, so you don't want to lift your head at all. And I remember laying there and just hearing like, and going, oh, geez, that's going to hit me pretty soon. And then hearing, and going, oh, that's still not here yet, huh? That's further away than I thought. And it's like, and then it's, you get right to the point where your brain goes, you know, I bet you I could just stand up and get out of here. And then it's boom, and that's when it hits you. So the key to a lot of this stuff is to try to trick your brain into not getting into that sort of fight or flight mode of where your body will actively just say, no, this is a bad idea.
But is it one of those things that after a while of doing it, like it's specifically for the motorcycles, you know, one or two have passed, you can kind of gauge by the sound on average how far everything is after
there's a myriad of other things to worry about at that point. So you move right past the sound being the biggest problem.
And then on to the next problem.
And on to the next problem, yeah, which goes through the fear of being crushed to death. So
fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. Cool. Anything else to add, Josh, on that segment?
Well, no. So I think it's pretty cool because I do a lot of snowboarding, and it's kind of the same thing where you come up to a big jump and you're going to be suspended in the air like 10 feet coming back down. Sure, you might think of, oh, this is like a parabolic arc, you know? There's some physics here, but you're more so concerned about how hard the impact's going to be on your knees when you land.
Yeah, that's the thing. I used to do professional wrestling, and I remember one time jumping off of this really tall ladder to go through a guy on a table. And I remember falling and reaching a point where you recognize that you're falling, and you're kind of like, huh, I wonder if I'm at terminal velocity here. Well, bang! And then you actually hit something. But yeah.
Oh, wonderful. That's incredible.
Yeah. So I used to get hit in the head a lot. That's I'm why sure, I don't I'm remember sure. a lot of the physics that I used to know, too.
You heard it here first. Anyone can do it.
I am in no way endorsing my choice of life path to anybody else.
Fair enough. So, no, Josh, you're on it.
Oh, you want to take it?
We haven't fully figured out how to cue between us yet. So, we'll get to that.
Cool. Okay. So I was just gonna say. So it seems from the get-go you wanted to do the sideshow thing. So why did you choose physics as a field to go into?
Well, I mean, so I was always pretty good academically in high school. And I was of the generation that there wasn't necessarily an option to not go to university, but it made a lot of sense to go. And there wasn't necessarily a lot of other avenues. It was kind of, for me, it was kind of stay on the farm or go out and you know, go to college or university. And, I mean, we didn't have any money, so I was going to have to pay for it myself. So I felt that if I was paying for something, that it should be something that I couldn't learn on my own. So I picked the hardest thing that I could find, which was physics, and that's what I took.
Jeez.
It seems to be a common trend between people in physics. You either have the set of people who are, I just want to learn how things work, and the other set that are, I'm good at school.
I mean, I was always interested in how things worked. So I knew science was definitely a route for me. And chemistry didn't necessarily have the challenge. Biology was just memorizing stuff. And so physics was difficult. It was either for me, it was actually going to be physics or history. I was interested in stories and interested in hearing stories and telling stories. And I thought history was something that I could read in a book, that there'd be a benefit. There's always a benefit to learning from other people. But I felt physics I'd never be able to do on my own. And so that was just kind of my choice at that point. Yeah.
And was there sort of, was that mentality what propelled you to go to master's? It's like, okay, I did the hard undergrad bit, now the next hardest thing in this would be master's.
No, by the time I got to my master's, I was actually interested in what I was doing. So I did a mathematics minor. Dr. Mass and I did the same thing. We were both mathematics and physics double majors because we recognized that we were already much better than the current math students in that year. who were math majors. So as double majors, we qualified for all their scholarships. So we would go in and basically get all of these scholarships, these math scholarships, so that we could still afford to go to school then. And then we just dropped out of the math, made math the minor in fourth year, and then declared physics as a major. Again, I don't necessarily recommend that to anybody, but I had spent a summer undergraduate research project working for Dr. Jim Stevens in the McNaughton building. And he was doing liquid crystal research. And that was the first sort of research that I had kind of discovered that was a physical thing. So much of like, I don't know what it's like for you as students, but I found that, you know, by the time I was in third and fourth year, I was like, okay, I'm great at math. I can solve differential equations. I don't know how anything works yet. And I've been doing this for 4 years. I was like, so sure, yeah. There's going to be a point here where I understand how an engine works or why a microwave works or anything like that. When I was doing the work in the lab, I was like, oh geez, like I'm actually working on a thing. And after that, lab position, we shared a lab with, Dr. John Dutcher and his group, which who at the time were studying polymer films. And that was a really exciting, field for me because we were looking at, nanotechnology or nanoscience and looking at long chain molecules that were more than just the traditional sort of crystalline packing structure or ping pong ball sort of model of things that I'd come to understand. So I liked how sort of strange and weird it was that you could take these molecules and confine them to some thickness that was on the order of the size of the molecule. First of all, that was a thing you could physically see. So you weren't looking at something that was like atomic length. You were looking at something that was like big, like a couple of widths of hair, you know, 100 nanometers, 200 nanometers. And you're looking at that thing, and that's already smaller than the molecule is long. And that was neat to me. But also what I found was exciting was I was scared that graduate work in physics was just going to be staring at a computer and collecting data points and fitting them to something. Where my work with the Dutcher group, I was able to go in and come up with an experiment and then go and build the equipment that you ran the experiment on and then use optical imaging techniques, microscopy and ellipsometry to look at these things and to study them and then to apply changes and then get data and information and do the mathematical modeling and everything. And for somebody like me who enjoyed tinkering, but also loved the math side and the theory side of it too, this kind of had everything for me. It gave me an opportunity to sort of flex every scientific muscle that I wanted to flex and to get away from the fear of just sitting behind a computer watching blips randomly appear. So I went straight from fourth year into my master's. I didn't have a break. I just went directly, continued, I did my fourth year project with Dr. Dutcher and continued straight on with that project into my master's.
Well, I definitely see what you mean about the whole theory, getting too stuck in the theory kind of feel and know all the math. I mean, last semester, a few students in our year tried to get a whole Arduino club going so that the students could have a bit more, kind of more practical electronics work besides the few little breadboard experiments you run in the
I always wanted to do a course for like third or fourth year that was like, you just picked... Like every week we would just pick a thing and we just learn how it worked. So how does a combustion engine like actually work? And just that week you break it down, explore the physics of the whole thing. And that's it at the end. You know, how does a microwave oven work? How does it generate microwaves? How does it stop anything? You know, I was literally up until my 20s when I thought there was like lead inside of it or something to block the microwaves before realizing that little mesh on the front is all that was actually scattering the waves for you. That's it. So it's like, I thought it would always be cool to have like as a fourth year class, just literally the physics of how things work.
I mean, I'm sure you can definitely, are definitely capable of putting that together maybe later on. I mean,
doubt that I'm an incredible educator. That's true. But,
I was going to say, especially now during remote learning, it would be, you know, the logistics would sort of be a bit more, You know, I take that back. I'm not an educator right now, so I don't know the logistics. But would you say that it would probably be easier to put together sort of a quick curriculum now and distribute it remotely? Or,
you know, I don't know. In terms of designing curriculum, there's so many things that need to be involved, and I think we're just on the brink of where remote teaching and virtual lecturing and virtual labs and things like that will actually take us. So I think it's too early really to make any kind of comparison, because we're kind of everybody's been kind of thrown into this before they were ready. And now we're just kind of not forced to scramble, but we're definitely playing catch up with trying to make this all work.
Right.
Now, that said, our department has done an incredible job. Our faculty has worked diligently and tirelessly to try to put together some of the best materials and programming that's happening right now. So they've done a great job. But I think, you know, we're in an odd, I mean, to use the already previously overused, we're in unprecedented times cliche. We are exactly that, in unprecedented times. So I'm curious to see where this is all going to take us.
Fair enough. Just going back to your research with masters, from what I understand, you also did a bit of PhD work, but didn't complete it fully. What was sort of the reservation?
Oh, well, I got through all my coursework and I was getting ready to study for my comps, and then I was lit on fire. So I was on fire for about 30 seconds, about half of my body. So I got third degree burns and was hospitalized for about 2.5-3 weeks, and then home nurse for about 2 months. So it caused me to have a bit of an evaluation of where my future was going at that point. So that point, I had to come up with the decision that, okay, what are you doing? Are you going to go through school and finish this? Because if you are, it's probably not worth dying on a weekend for a gig. Or are you serious about being an entertainer and you're just spinning your wheels at school? Because I found that doing the two at the time, at that moment point in my life, I wasn't fulfilling either to their full potential. So I made the decision at that point to move forward with entertaining full time, and that's when I dropped out of my PhD, because I figured I could always go back to school if it ever came to that point.
Fair enough.
But I might not always have those opportunities to continue sort of as an entertainer.
To be honest, that is a great reason though. Like that's going to be turned into a soundbite one day. Like, oh, honey, why aren't you doing your schoolwork? Oh, I got set on fire. What do you want me to do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little bit overly dramatic, but I guess so am I. But, you know, I think it's important for people to sort of evaluate where they are and what they want to do with their lives, because it's easy to sort of get bogged down with the path that you think you're supposed to follow. And that's, you know, maybe only because you've had the concept laid out in front of you. You know, often when I was in my PhD, I remember sitting there thinking like, I don't think I'm necessarily smarter or dumber than that other person who's working over in that other lab. But they have a PhD and I don't, or I have a PhD and they do. What is the purpose of that piece of paper that I was just chasing to prove to myself that I had a certain level of smartness, right? Like, you're a smart kid in high school and you think, oh, I'm supposed to go on and get a PhD. That's what you do. But it's easy enough to recognize that not all people have to follow that path.
Yeah. And you're also bogged down and sort of committed to very one specific topic in a specific field. I think Freeman Dyson's biggest reservations to having a PhD was that he couldn't just study one thing for the rest of his life.
Mm. Is that why he branched off into vacuum cleaners?
Oh gosh.
It's a little joke about Dyson vacuum cleaners, guys. Yeah, you know what? I don't think that bothered me, because I think I was chasing this piece of paper just to chase the paper for it.
Right.
And that's what I think it was for me. The work that I was doing, because I had done my master's in polymer physics and I was moving into microfluidics and lab on a chip sort of devices. There was a lot of versatility within the field that I was studying to kind of study whatever. And, you know, as a role model, Dr. Dutcher, you know, has done a myriad different fields that he's explored and sort of examined. So we were never really sort of mentored in our lab to think, oh, you have to stick to this thing. We were very interdisciplinary and very sort of open. But for me, it just, my heart wasn't in it. And I just kind of had to, you know, almost dying was a nice way to kind of have to sit down and evaluate this idea that, what do you want to do and what are you doing with your life?
Fair enough. I doubt very many people get that sort of sign or kind of realization until it's too late sometimes. So
probably not, but I'm quite exceptional. So
fair enough. Fair enough. Go ahead, Joe.
So yeah. So that takes you out your PhD and then you start performing full time. And then eventually you end up coming back
to
academia, right? And it seems, at least from what I've seen in terms of the department and stuff, that you're kind of in the section of the department that's more so focused on the education aspect, less so the kind of PhD route people, but just getting the engagement in physics, the education good, or well, rather. And I was just curious if you've seen any new education like techniques in the recent years compared to the traditional kind of you need to go sit and read a book.
Oh yeah. I mean, I've been lecturing now for I guess about 12 years. And in that time we kind of made the transition from people using traditional methods of studying you know, or even just of creating your lesson plan of okay, this is the chapter we're going to cover next week. You know, read this material, read this paper, do these problems, come to class prepared. To just the world changing to a place where people don't read textbooks. And people who are used to the delivery of their information coming from an online source rather than sitting down and actually studying. So it's been interesting to see that adaptation, that change over time. And again, our department's been very good about engaging with that. So probably about 4 or 5 years ago now, I was involved with an LEF grant that was, purpose was to flip the classroom for 1080, which is one of our physics for biological sciences. It's one of the large service courses for in first year physics for the biology students. And the idea behind that one was creating modules of pre-lecture material, which included video and giving that or delivering that to the student prior to them coming to the classroom. So instead of taking the model of read this chapter, it was watch these videos about material that we would typically talk about in class and then do a quick little quiz or test on it, see where the gaps are in the knowledge there and attack those sort of areas. And that worked out really well, but it also gave us sort of a head start on preparing pre-lecture material and preparing videos. So that's kind of the biggest change that I've seen take place. I mean, as an educator, I'll be the first one to readily admit during that transition, it was easy for me to get mad at students for not preparing or for not reading, you know, and it's one of those things you're trying to teach them. You're saying, well, why didn't you read that chapter of the book? But then if you go back and look at the way that education has been, they've been handling education up until that point in that person's life. If they didn't have ever been taught to read that book prior to coming to class, then why would they start doing it now? So you're at a position where just the methods of the ways people have learned or are learning have changed. So we have to keep up with it.
Which student do you think would fare better in the modern times? The traditional student who's perfectly comfortable reading the textbook or the modern student?
Well, since the difference between them is only about 10 years, then I'd say they're probably both doing okay right now. I mean, you and I both live in this world at the same time. So, I mean, there is that. No, but it's hard to say, you know, because I think there's so much knowledge in books in the world. And in the same way that you can watch two different presentations of a topic on YouTube and you might really engage with one, but your peer might engage with the other one. That's how books are to people. And oftentimes I think we get, especially in physics, we kind of get sandbagged with this idea that the textbook is the source. And the textbook is just one of many sources. One textbook might be incredibly boring to you and not make any sense whatsoever, but a different textbook on that same exact subject might tackle it in a completely different way that totally makes sense to you. As you progress in your physics and look back at the stuff you've learned and on ways to even teach it sometimes things as simple as just the order in which you teach it makes a huge difference on where you grasp the concepts.
Very cool. So on that note, we're actually approaching the end of our time commitment here, but
thank
on
God.
That note, I know, right? Seriously. On that note, though, I do wanted to ask, I don't know if this is classified or not, but are you at liberty to tell us, you know, the forecast for the coming semester and the coming year? Do you know if it'll be online? Do you know if it'll be, you know, some reopening in the school? Can you
well, I don't know when this will drop, but tomorrow they're calling for rain now. Friday, it's going to be -6, but a high of 4.
Okay.
Saturday, looking like a sunny Halloween. We're going to break a negative temperature there. That was your, you had mentioned what the forecast was. And so
I fumbled trying
to get my phone in a fast enough amount of time to open the weather app. It's just an example of the hilarious prop comedy that I've become a master of in the last 20 years. But the thing is, you'll know as soon as we do. It's not like there's a secret cabal that's judging this. People are just concerned about safety. So,
fair enough.
You know, when it's safe enough, I guess, for people to come back on campus, then people will be able to come back on campus. But I personally think that this semester will change the face of education moving forward, though. I think we'll see more virtual lecturing. I think we'll see people change this idea of maybe looking at more pre-lecture material. It's kind of interesting, you know, the generation before mine, who were going to the university in the 70s and 80s, had a lot more of this kind of like sit down, come into lecture and chat and talk and explore ideas, right? And my generation, when we came in, it was kind of a lot more of this like standardized lecture. Like, this is the topic. Here's the material. You're going to learn it in lecture. And now I think we're going to see a change maybe back to this. Just personally, I think we might see a change back to the old sort of method of here's pre-lecture material. Look at this, engage with it. And now when you come back in the classroom, let's talk about that. Let's have a dialogue. So it's exciting either way. And there's pros and cons for both of them or both methods. And there's pros and cons for the ways people just learn. So I'm excited to kind of see what this is moving forward. And I think embracing technology, especially in an age now where technologically, I mean, there's people that couldn't exist without their phone. you know, it's just become so much a part of who they are.
Right.
So I think, you know, engaging with that and trying to reach people through that can only be a good thing.
So then correct me if I'm wrong. Does that mean that our generation of students right now in this semester, are we technically pioneers?
I mean, I wouldn't use that word, but yeah. I mean, it's nice to hear you say it.
It sounded a lot better in my head.
I mean, it is. I mean, in all honesty, I mean, look at these the students who are coming in to university right now, right? They're the first generation of students coming into first year virtual university. Across the entire country, they're part of that cohort. It's a fascinating thing to think of if you really let that idea sink in to how that'll be regarded in future generations, right? It's almost like a Jetsons kind of style future, to use an incredibly, I'm sure, a topic that's on the finger on the pulse of youth culture right now, right? You guys still watch the Jetsons? That's a huge thing for everybody. We're watching the Jetsons and the Flintstones and Petticoat Junction. Those are still big, right? But I mean, you see all those old cartoons from the 60s and the 70s of what the future would be. You know, you sit down in front of a box and the teacher is on the box and they talk to you and you don't even have to leave the house. That's what's happening now. Like we are, they just found water on the moon yesterday, guys. Like there's going to be moon bases now. Like this is we're living through a time of incredible technological change that reminds me of kind of the advent of nuclear physics, sort of in the 50s and the 60s and the late 40s there, and how quickly technology changed as a result of unlocking a few key things. The world's never been as connected as it is now. And that interconnectivity between everybody, you've got a global identity now, more so than you do a local identity. You have people who have friends that live across the world, but might not even know people in their own community. So it's a really interesting time to sort of visualize what that's like and how that'll change and what it does to anything.
Yeah, and we'll...
Moon pies, kids! We're living in a time of moon pies.
Absolutely. All right. So
we got like a fun like closing bit here that we're going to do. I thought that weather gag I did there was a pretty good thing to end on. You might want to use that every time.
I shouldn't have continued. I should have just cut it there. But we're approaching our time. I guess the last little bit is, you know, where can the listeners of this podcast read more about you? You know, devour more of your content per se. Where can they find you?
Well, there's vast archives of things that I've done that no one cares about that you can find all over the place. For the most current things that people tend to not care about, you can follow me on my Instagram. It's the_great_Orbax, because when I signed up, I thought underscores were a good idea at the time. That's mostly my freak show related content and my home life. So you'll be lots of pictures of cats and then occasionally pictures of me covered with blood. If you want to follow, Pepper and I do a science show for kids, called Orbax and Pepper Do Science. That was the basis for the Guinness World Record book, Guinness World Record Science and Stuff. You can follow that on the social medias if you've got a junior scientist in your home who you think would be interested, and that's at Orbax and Pepper Do Science on Facebook, Instagram, and on YouTube. And that's probably, good enough for me personally. If you want to follow the exciting stuff that we're doing in the physics department, you can follow FIGU on Instagram at FIGU, and same on YouTube. We've also got a Guelph Physics Twitter, and there's a Guelph Physics Facebook page as well. And that's where we do updates. We've got all types of information and activities and surprises coming for this semester. We just did our first live streaming event where we had a candid chat with Dr. John Dutcher about nanoscience and about his budding, the creation of Murexis Biotechnologies, his business that came directly out of experiments that they were doing in the lab. And it's an interesting chat. So we're going to try to do more of that type of stuff.
Awesome. And you, sir, you and Pepper also run your own personal podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do. We have a podcast. Yeah. Orbax and Pepper do a podcast, which you can follow on all fantastic podcast platforms where you get your podcast for free. Every week we have a sit-down chat interview with one of our many entertainer friends who basically can't do anything right now. So they're stuck having to take phone calls from us. So we've had some pretty fun guests, such as Bill Moseley, who was Chop Top in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Or Otis from House of a Thousand Corpses. We chatted with our pal Doyle from The Misfits. And we talked to other magicians and sideshow performers, The Lizard Man. We have lots of friends who do lots of various things. So if you're interested in some kind of popular culture, there's likely one of our podcasts that would be of interest to you.
And I think the fact that you interviewed Doyle was insane. I'm a big Misfits fan. So
nice. Doyle's like, a pal. He's great.
I might go vegan now because he convinced me to. It's insane.
Well, that's that line. I mean, you know, in the end, you're just paying somebody to kill an animal for you.
Oof.
But that's actually where I got my retinal detachment. We went down to see Doyle and the Misfits play in Philly there around Christmas time, mid-December there. And that's when the ride back was when my retina started detaching from my eyeball.
Jeez.
Yeah. So that was a fun story.
Alrighty then. So I guess the closing statement will probably be just an announcement for those who are listening. So we're actually going to, this isn't the normal format of the show. We were talking about doing a format where we bring in one or two professors and then one or two students. And then the hosts, of course, and then we would have like a roundtable discussion about a topic. And that's very easy to do now since everything's being done remotely. So if anyone wants to come on and sort of have a chat, we're going to be posting announcements to our Instagram and Discord for the University of Guelph Physics Club. So you can go and follow the Instagram on UOGPAC. That is UOGPAC is the Instagram. And then the Discord is U of G PAC. Don't confuse them. So we'll be announcing to both of those. And anyone is welcome to join.
And I would throw this. I would throw this out there, and feel free to edit it out, as I assume you will most of what I've said. But I would throw it out there and see what the listeners want to hear.
Absolutely.
Do the listeners want it to be a one-on-one interview? Do they want it to be a panel discussion? Are they interested in both? You know, message them on the Discord or hit them up on Instagram and let them know what shape you want this show to take.
Sure. Yeah, we can. There doesn't have to be anything concrete. We can mix it up, change it up. Any final comments, final questions? Yes.
Well, I just wanted to make sure. I think a valuable thing that I put out there earlier, maybe we didn't entirely eloquently discuss it, but I would like to leave people with the idea that, you know, nobody's making you do anything. So it's important to sort of sit down every once in a while and evaluate what you're doing and understand that if it's in service to a greater goal of something that you wish to get, or just to see if you're wasting time. Because if you're wasting time, you're probably going to miss out on doing something else that you really want to do. So you can sit there and you can think constantly about all the possibilities that where life might take you, or you can go out and do those possibilities. So if I can leave you with one word of advice, one thing that I've learned, it's that nothing is holding you back except for yourself. So figure out what you want to do and go try and do it, because you don't want to be sitting there thinking, huh, I really wish I had done that.
Fair enough.
Or not done that, like the case of me in this podcast.
Fair enough. And I think with those words of wisdom, we'll sign off. I didn't hit record. No, I'm kidding. Don't worry.
That's usually my gag. I'm usually like, oh, that was a great practice one, guys. All right, let's start with the real one.
Ha ha. Gotcha. Anyway, so yeah, awesome. Thank you so much again. Seasonal lecture Orbach, not professor.
Sessional.
I messed it up again. Shoot.
I do like seasonal lecture as a thing. It's like
sessional. Fair enough.
I've actually got an official title now. I recently got a job, so I am now. Let me bring up my email here to see what I actually am. I am now a production specialist in physics education.
All right, then. Production specialist in physics education, Orbach. Thank you so much.
It flows off the tongue, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You'll have to abbreviate that, and we'll the next time we reconvene, you let us know. So, yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you so much, Josh. And, yeah, episode 1. Thank you all for listening, and take care.